of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. This radio program is brought to you by the initiative Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, religions and faiths, and the care of the earth. So these are some highlights from the year 2022, and I hope that you'll enjoy them. And if you'd like to know who the speaker is behind the voice, please check out my website at www.studyjoy.nz.
The churches are open, the schools are open. So our schools have been closed for 2 years, you can imagine.
2 years? Oh.
2 years.
And how did the students learn in the meantime?
Well, some that could manage, those that come from rich families, you know, could learn online. Mm-hmm. But majority did not learn.
You are the director of a Catholic school. What did you do to connect the children to the school during the 2 years?
Really nothing, because the school is located in a rural area, and at home the children cannot access the internet. So we had to leave it as just that until now that we have opened again.
When I came to Wellington, as part of the Wellington Interfaith Council, I used to sit down with my Sikh friend, Manjit. We discussed various harebrained schemes for helping to house the homeless people in Wellington. And then when COVID happened, they got housed. And so we didn't have the housing problem anymore. And I was surfing the net. There's not much else to do when you're in lockdown.
Yes.
And I was reading that in Europe there's 500 million tyres a year going into the tips. And if you knock that down to New Zealand numbers, it's not unusual to see belts made out of bicycle tyres. I thought that's a good idea. And I thought, hey, what about those homeless people we were talking about? Why don't we get them involved? So when we came out of lockdown, that's exactly what we did. The Sikhs put in a seed fund through the umbrella Indian organization called ECTA. With the help of the Salvation Army, we started working. And that was in 2020, and we're just going since then.
I saw a real need for songs for primary school children which were accessible to them musically and lyrically, but they still had some theological depth to them. So when I was when I started teaching in the early 80s, a lot of the songs that in primary schools we sang were sort of, I call them the rainbow daffodil and butterfly songs, and they were cute and they were fun and they were good for religious education, but we kind of tried to squeeze them in to make them gathering songs or communion songs, and they weren't, you know. So I thought, surely we can get music which is still attractive and accessible to children, but it actually matches what we're trying to do liturgically and theologically. So that's what started me off. Chant was the original way that music really came with liturgy, and there's chant is still used in the church today, as we know. But the church, in its own words, has welcomed all different styles of music as long as it can be made suitable for the liturgy. And I think there's a breadth of stuff that we can use, and particularly if we look at it culturally, we know that when missionaries came to the Pacific Islands and Africa and South America, with the blessing of the church, the whole idea of liturgical enculturation happened, where we adopted some of the cultural traditions, particularly musical traditions, from some of the places where missionaries were spreading the gospel. And I think we're doing that culturally today. Like music is such a big part of contemporary culture, be it in South America or Auckland or Christchurch or Sydney or Brisbane, you know, or the outback. So I'm very open to looking at the how we can enculturate our liturgy with the local musical culture.
It's the Pietà by Michelangelo. What do we know about the creation of this masterpiece?
Indeed. Thanks, Beate. It was originally commissioned by a French cardinal who was the papal ambassador, the French ambassador to Rome. And Rome at the time was the capital of the papal state. So it was commissioned by the cardinal for the French chapel in the old St. Peter's Basilica, the basilica built by Constantine in the 4th century for the cardinal's funeral piece. So it would have been an extraordinary work of art, unprecedented in its time in Rome, being a high Renaissance work of a Florentine sculptor in what was essentially an old medieval basilica, the first St. Peter's. So the Pope at the time was Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI. So the French cardinal was commissioning it to a Florentine sculptor again for a piece in Rome. So it was a very important work for Michelangelo because he was young at the time when he got the commission. He was only 23 in 1498. He was now coming to Rome, to a city that he would not have been well known in, to do a work of art for a French ambassador.
I consider a song is just like a monologue. It just obviously has the heightened nature of music underneath. But you still need all of the storytelling skills and great connection to the audience when you're singing, as if you're acting. So for me, whether it is on any type of production, I'm always really, you know, looking at the character and their journey. I would say I probably get my most satisfaction from the stage because I like being able to complete the full story in that one evening. Whereas when you're shooting a film or a television series, you're often doing things out of order. You know, you might be doing scenes from the last episode on your first day. So you really have to have a sense of where you've come from and where you're going to as a character. But I love the variety. I think in New Zealand you don't get pigeonholed. And that's really, really, really wonderful. So it means I've really had such a wide variety in my career. And long may that last. Like if you'd asked me 5 years ago, would I have been directing a short film? I probably would have laughed at you, but I did that last year. And if you said you'd be directing something in a television studio, I would have laughed at you, and I did that this year. So, you know, older and bolder, trying things, that's mostly what I'm interested in, is new, exciting experiences. The intimacy coordinator puts in, if you think of us more like a stunt coordinator, we go in and break down the physical beats of the moment, like you would a stunt, and then the emotional beats, and we put those together. But we use, obviously, a third party with the intimacy. I'll call it IC for short. That means that we are not leaving the actors to look after each other because that's not their job. We are making sure that there is consent. That's probably the three tenets of our work: communication, transparency, and consent. Make sure everybody knows what they're doing, everybody knows what they're up for, everybody agrees where they're being touched. And, you know, everybody has boundaries on their body. We carry things as people for many years. And it might just be that somebody doesn't want to be touched on a certain part of their neck, but the other part is fine, you know? So we find other creative routes to create everything that we need to in a scene while still giving some autonomy to the actors. So it's been a game changer for actors.
a lot of the major developments have been within an ecumenical environment, where Christians across a variety of denominational identities through the organ, for example, of the World Council of Churches or other regional groupings, engaging with people of other faiths who are themselves very often ecumenical in the sense that there are diverse expressions of every major religion and diverse identities. And so often it's a case of one form of ecumenism meeting with another form of ecumenism, if you put it that way.
Maybe you can just again clarify the difference between ecumenism and interfaith.
Sure, sure. Well, ecumenism, which derives from a Greek word oikoumene, meaning the whole inhabited earth, or the sense of being together, was coined within obviously a Christian religious context, and was a movement that began or emerged out of the late 19th century, when initially Christian missionaries from different organizations and different churches began to ask the question, why are we competing with one another in the missionary field in terms of evangelical conversion? We're all trying to bring people to the same Lord, but we're doing it through different routes and it becomes confusing. So that began the movement, or one of the features that began the movement in the 20th century, for Christians who had grown used to the sense of a really big diversity of denominational identity, such that, for example, when you go to the 19th century and early 20th century, and anything that references what we might today call religious diversity was actually talking about Christian diversity. Not other faiths, Christian diversity. So ecumenism came out of the context of trying to resolve issues, competitive praxis, and so on, relating to a diversity of Christian denominational identities and breaking down barriers that Christians have put up. Like for a long time, you know, a Methodist wouldn't be seen dead with a Catholic, or vice versa, you know, that kind of thing. You know, since then I've been to Rome several times, well, warmly welcomed every time. So that's ecumenism, is actually, you might say, crossing borders and boundaries and evolving relationships within the diversity of one religious tradition. And although the term was coined within Christianity, you can, by analogy, apply it into other religious contexts as well. Whereas interreligious engagement, dialogue, or interfaith activities or whatever are across the main religious identities and the main religions themselves, however they may be expressed.
Son of David, son of Abraham. Now, I couldn't think of a better way of going into the New Testament than the genealogy that tells us all about the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. And the whole thing is that the New Testament is hidden in the Old Testament. I mean, if we don't know the Old Testament, it's just a list of meaningless names. But they're there for a purpose, to establish the identity of Jesus. This, of course, is the most Jewish of the Gospels, and there are genealogies right through the Old Testament. Genesis 10 is a complete genealogy, and the sort of the ancestry, we all carry the ancestry of others of the past, and that establishes our identity now. If we want to know who Jesus is, we go to his own scriptures. And there's such a, it's a list of names, sure, but it's got a purpose.
So, Brother Kieran, would you compare it to like a whakapapa?
Absolutely, because a whakapapa establishes the identity of someone today in terms of their past. And really, unless we appreciate the story of the Hebrew Scriptures, then how can we appreciate the one who is the fulfillment of them?
Th-
this is a very important COP because here in Egypt, Egypt, of course, considers itself very much part of the Middle East, very much part of Africa. And so this is being very much considered the African COP, which is hugely important because whilst the population of the whole extraordinary continent of Africa is only about 1.2 billion people at the moment, over coming decades, this is where all the fastest growth in population, economy and emissions is going to be. And therefore, it's really important for the world to come around Africa and then support them to take a big leap forward. So they don't go through, you know, old stages of fossil fuels and everything else to get to climate compatible economies and societies, that they leapfrog. And they have experience in this. So, for example, with phones, many countries had pretty dire landline phone systems. But when mobile phones came along, they leapt straight to that and became great pioneers in payments by mobile phones and things like that. So there's a huge excitement here about that. So that does make this COP different. And of course, each COP is very much influenced by the mood of the time. And of course, given the climate catastrophes that are escalating, particularly over this past year and all the geopolitics and everything else around that, that's very intense here. But it also reflects the host country, both in location and the style of the host government, which is Egypt, which of course is an autocratic government.
What do you like about the events of exploring sacred spaces?
I think this is a very unique kind of event, which is part of a social calendar for many people in Auckland. And it sits under the Auckland Heritage Festival, which is organized by the Auckland Council, which makes it even more special, because it gives that much needed kind of a publicity to an event which promotes social cohesion and harmony among faith communities and also among the general public as well. It is an open invitation for public to visit any of the sacred spaces that is advertised or in that particular year. Yeah, there are different types of temples within the country of India. India being a civilizational state, and it has been there for thousands of years, and people have worshipped the Almighty, the Divine, in many forms, in many ways, using many sacred spaces. The South Indian temple is very different in the sense that the architecture that has been used in the South Indian temples is of a different sacred geometry. You have tall kind of, gates and what we call as the gopurams on the top. The sculpture of the temple is so unique. The deity is normally in black granite, stone and, carved exquisitely, by the sculptors. And they are very opulent and palatial in origin. So,
these deities, are they carved in New Zealand or are they carved in South India and then brought to New Zealand?
Mostly in South India.
The beauty of all of the Gospels, they've all got four quite distinct pictures of Mary. Mark's just given a faint outline. Matthew gives a slightly stronger sketch. Luke gives us Jesus' first disciple, Mary, who ponders over the words spoken to her about her son and acts on them. And John, we get a full picture of her role at Cana and Calvary. But in no gospel is she the dominant figure. Always she's in relationship with her son and a pointer towards him. What is so fascinating is the way that the portrait of Mary develops through the four Gospels.
We have two processes going on in tradition. We have the tradition that we think of as constantly drawing more and more depth out of the origins and elaborating them. But we also have tradition in the sense that it gets confused with other things. One of the problems that Christianity faced when it moved into the Greek world, and more importantly, when it moved out of the Jewish world, was that it moved into a religious culture which decried the ordinary. The ordinary was awful. The ordinary was the sordid. And religion became, the ideal Greek religion is a religion of wondrous gods and wondrous heroes and wondrous divine beings who get on with their life parallel to us in an upper space. And they're not, religion is noted by how different it is to our life. And indeed, religion can be compartmentalized and taken almost outside of life, except for when you engage in these acts of religion, linking, which literally means linking up.
It came out of some conversations, unfortunately, after the shootings in Christchurch. And there were a lot of conversations about, you know, now, unfortunately, we have more disabled people. The mosques and the Muslim community, all the communities in Christchurch and around New Zealand really came together beautifully, you know, to support the victims and the impacted communities at the time. But then as there have been inquiries and as projects and conversations and consultations have flowed out, their different needs have been identified. And so in this project, we're not just focusing on the Muslim community, but we are wondering how faith communities disable people unnecessarily. And so we want to pursue ways that we can flip that around.
So when you say of disabled people, that includes all disabled, physical and mental and any disability?
Yes, I've learned so much in this project. So if I misspeak or get something wrong, I hope your listeners will know that it's just my ignorance, you know, as I'm still learning as we go. But yes, it is all disabilities, both those that someone was born with and those that were acquired. It does include the elderly. The elderly increasingly have disabilities that as I get older, I live as if, you know, that won't happen to me. And so it's easy for me to ignore some disabilities. And then later on in life, I might end up in a similar situation and think, oh, I should have paid attention. I should have been kinder, you know, along the way. So yes, all disabilities. It can be sensory. It can be mobility, neurodiverse, hidden disabilities. That's a new thing that I've learned about. So yes, all disabilities. How can they fully participate in their faith communities? Without too much focus on their disability, but more celebration and good use of their ability. Some people were fascinated that there would be such a big project that focused in any way on religion. Many times we want to say we will support, you know, the security of people, maybe the housing of people, their financial well-being, nutrition, health, you know, different things. But the religious side of people is so often, or the spiritual side is so often ignored. And yet we have Sir Mason Drury's model of the Te Whare Tapawhā, where there's the four different components to who it is, you know, to be Māori and to be a human. Even in my work as a chaplain at the university, so many times, the essence of humanity, the spirit, is just ignored. And we're kind of turned into useful or not useful, productive or not productive. It's fascinating how that part is often ignored. So that's often a response to it. The other thing is, are there that many disabled people who are religious? Well, when you look at the number of people in society, in our society here in New Zealand, who are religious or spiritual, 3/4 of New Zealanders will put down on the census a faith tradition or background of some sort. And if you think about the statistics of people who are disabled, and you think they have certain impairments that potentially limit how they engage in the world around them. Wouldn't it be lovely if they had all the resources and assets of their spirituality to support them as they go forward? So whether they are spiritual or whether they have a formal religion, they're part of an organized religion, wouldn't it be a comfort and a joy for them to be able to have full access to all of who they are?
These massive challenges that we are facing as the world, basically. So it's two things. One, we live on this planet and we use its resources, its renewable resources, as if we have a second planet in our back pocket. And so that is not sustainable. We can't keep living the way we're living and just exploiting. So it has to come back to this regenerative thinking. So that's one element. And the other part is we still need to we're facing a planet with, you know, 10 billion people, and these people, you know, we need to dress people, we need, you know, furniture, we need our day-to-day items for living, and we can talk about, you know, we can design them better, we can reuse them better, we can limit our, you know, fashion to, instead of six fashion cycles, to one. So there are all these things, but we still need material, we still need energy. And if we don't want to use fossil resources, because the more of that we use, the more CO2 we release in the atmosphere, the worse we make the climate challenge. We need to find alternatives. And so this is where, for example, biomass, trees and other bio-based feedstock is absolutely urgent. And we start to relearn basically how to use that.
Can you give us some examples?
Oh, there is. It's an interesting one. If I look at my work or the areas that I'm looking after, there is both in the material side, but also on the energies. Material being product. So you could imagine some of the plastics we are using today. They can be designed better instead of making the plastics as it is now from fossil or from crude oil. You can make it from material coming from a tree, for example. And sustainable is more than just economic sustainable, like running a profitable business. It has to be socially sustainable, and it has to be environmentally, ecologically sustainable. If you take these lenses now forward, what has been done there with, going into the tropical rainforest, chopping down the rainforest and planting monocultures, does not meet the criteria of sustainability. It's the question is not if, it's like when we do that. It's a little bit like the Stone Age. The Stone Age didn't stop because we were running out of stones. The Stone Age stopped because we developed better materials. And this is the same with the Fossil Age. We will not drill into the ground until we've taken the last drop of oil out. New and better ways are coming. And a lot of predictions look at, say, the year 2050, for example, where we will likely use three times as much plastics. But that plastics will come from better recycled systems. It will come from bio-based systems, you know, it could be from trees, but also from direct use of CO2 in the atmosphere.
That you have enjoyed this selection of different snippets of interviews from 2022. If you would like to listen to the whole interview of one of our guests, please let me know and check out the website at www.studyjoy.nz. I wish you a very happy Christmas and many blessings for the year 2023. Kia kaha, keep safe. Thank you.
Out there, old pieces calling in the bond of love we meet for the world a new day dawn.